This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 6th of November, these are our main stories. The first preliminary wave of national exit poll data in the US has just been released, with voters saying the state of democracy and the economy were the most important issues when deciding who to vote for as president. The Israeli Prime Minister has fired his defense secretary, Yoav Gallant, and a French court has convicted a gang of people smugglers after the biggest trial so far involving those operating small boats in the English Channel. Also in this podcast...
She was telling her mum off yesterday, tried because she wants to get some food, and she's running around and she's flicking her head about trying to get mum to lie down, so just knows what she wants.
Haggis, the newborn pygmy hippo, a sensation at Edinburgh Zoo. Now, as we record this podcast, with many polls still open across the United States, the first preliminary wave of national exit poll data has just been released, with voters saying the state of democracy and the economy are the most important issues when deciding who to vote for as president. The BBC's North America editor, Sarah Smith, is with the Harris campaign in Howard University, which is just 3 kilometres from the White House, and she spoke to Nuala McGovern.
We may be waiting quite some time before we see Kamala Harris herself, of course, because who knows whether there'll even be a result for her to come out and talk about here. But there is a stage all set up, lined with the stars and stripes, and it's got a podium ready for her to stride up to, if indeed she has an acceptance speech to make or has to concede defeat. But who knows when that might be. In the meantime, there are television and broadcast crews, journalists from all over the world. I mean, it couldn't be more international, the press pack that I am with here, because there is such intense interest in this election from every corner of the globe.
Really quite something, particularly when you think of such a short run-up that she had to this huge night. I mentioned Howard University, that it is a historically black college and university in the United States. And interesting, she has picked that place to make it her night.
Yeah, and she studied here. She graduated from here in 1986, so it'll be something of a homecoming for her when she gets here. Whether it's a joyous one or not remains to be seen. But it's very emblematic that she has chosen a historically black college and university in which to make this speech. She's always made a very great deal, in fact, of the sorority sisters that she joined here, and they have helped her a great deal through her campaign and her career. And it will be a very, very momentous moment, of course, if she walks out here onto this stage in front of me and becomes the first female president, let alone the first black female president or South Asian female president. You know, this will be a very historic moment, and she's chosen a very apt setting if indeed that's what happens later. We just don't know.
So how about Donald Trump, the former president, bidding to become the next president? The BBC's Gary O'Donoghue is in West Palm Beach near Mar-a-Lago, the private club in Florida where Mr. Trump lives and where he'll spend this evening.
We're expecting, possibly at some point during the evening, that Donald Trump may come over. And we're hearing, of course, that some of the advisers in his campaign are suggesting that he should claim victory early if he's ahead in some of those swing states you've been talking about. Other elements suggesting that he could end up looking very foolish if he does it too early. I think the one thing we do know is that Donald Trump will make up his own mind on that one. He did say earlier in the day when he was voting over on Palm Beach that he would accept the result if, he said, if the election was fair.
If the election was fair, but that is the very big if. It's interesting, though, that you've got that competing narrative about whether to come out early or not.
Yeah, and of course, there's background, isn't there? There's history to this. Back in 2020, where I was there standing a few yards from the West Wing when he came out at 2:30 in the morning, claimed victory. And it was an incredibly shocking moment because no one knew who'd won the election at that point. No one could say whether he'd won it or whether Joe Biden had won it. And then we know what happened in the subsequent weeks after that, culminating, of course, on January the 6th and the storming of the Capitol. So I think there are clearly divided opinions on what he should do tonight. And the complicating factor here is that last time around, Republicans were very cautious about voting by mail and things like that, and Democrats did that in huge numbers. Republicans have done it much more this time. So he may start to see his numbers pick up you know, later on in the counting process in some of those places where there are large mail-in ballots. So it's going to be more complex this time around rather than last time where we saw him ahead in Pennsylvania, you know, this crucial state, and then Joe Biden gradually overtake him in the subsequent days until Pennsylvania was declared 4 days later on the Saturday, and that's what put Joe Biden over the top.
That was Gary O'Donoghue in Florida. So what have been the big issues in this election? Valerie Sanderson spoke to Rowan Bridge in Washington.
I mean, I think the overriding issue for most people in this election is the economy, frankly. It's like, you know, this is a story that's been true for the past 30 years. It was James Carville who worked on Bill Clinton's campaign who coined the phrase, "It's the economy, stupid," meaning that that is the thing that drives voters perhaps more than anything else. And Kamala Harris faces the challenge that post-pandemic inflation has been high in this country. And a lot of people have felt that. You know, if you talk to some of the Trump voters that I spoke to this morning, for example, you know, whether they like Trump's bombastic style or not, most of them felt better off economically under Donald Trump and felt the country was doing better economically under Donald Trump. And I think in that clip that you played there of Kamala Harris, there's a sort of acknowledgement of it. She's sort of talking about what she will do for the economy, knowing that that is an issue that's very important to voters. Then outside that, they both have their own issues that they think play well for them. In Donald Trump's case, that's immigration, and he's made great play of immigration in his campaign rallies. For Kamala Harris, she's appealed to kind of women voters and moderate Republican women voters particularly over the issue of abortion and abortion rights. So I think the economy is an overall issue that affects everybody. And underneath that, both sides feel there are other issues that play well for them.
And Ron, who do you think are the people who are going to decide this election? I mean, is it going to be older women? Is it going to be younger men?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. The answer is it could be either of the above. You have, as you say, a country that is kind of split down the middle. And so in which case you are talking about, are there sections of the electorate that you can either peel off from the other side or maybe undecided or don't normally vote, that you can pull out and vote for your side? In Donald Trump's case, if you listen to a lot of his speeches, a lot of his approach, it's been a kind of sort of laddish appeal to young men. If you look at where he's appeared, it's been on podcasts that appeal to men who wouldn't watch the news, who were low propensity voters, as they call them, people who don't normally go out to vote. Now, has Donald Trump's strategy and approach and language motivated those people to turn out? If they do, that could be significant for Donald Trump. Kamala Harris has specifically targeted, you hear her talk a lot about young voters. She's been appearing on university campuses for some of her rallies. And she's talked about the issue of abortion, which she thinks appeals to moderate Republican women. We've seen people like Liz Cheney, who's a former conservative Republican congresswoman, campaigning for Kamala Harris. She thinks that that is going to be something that brings out moderate Republican women who may vote for her. And that could be crucial in this election.
Rowan, I know this is an impossible question. I have to ask it. I mean, when are we going to know the result? Is it going to be days, hours, weeks?
Well, it's a very good question. And I think it ultimately comes down to, you know, how close are some of these races? So let's look at past history. You know, 2012, Barack Obama, the polls closed in California and the US networks basically declared him a winner straight away. 2016, Donald Trump declared the winner early hours of the following morning. Joe Biden took till the weekend. What I'm saying is it could be any of those scenarios.
That was Rowan Bridge in Washington. Well, the last polling stations will close in Hawaii and Alaska at midnight US Eastern Time. That's 5 o'clock GMT. With the chance of recounts and legal challenges, it could be a few days before a winner is declared. Our correspondent John Sudworth has this report on how the US electoral system works and why the final result will be decided by a few swing states.
As Americans cast their ballots, it's not the popular vote that matters. Instead, residents of each US state are voting for a share of the 538 seats that make up what's known as the Electoral College. The first candidate to reach one more than half of those seats, 270, is the winner. It's mostly a first-past-the-post system in each state. Candidates who lose even by a small margin get nothing, which can lead to interesting outcomes, as in 2016. Aníbal Pérez Linán is a professor of global affairs at Notre Dame University.
The election was very tight, right? But if you just count the number of votes at the national level, there was a slight advantage for Hillary Clinton. But then when you translate those votes state by state into electoral and into electors, right, the majority of the electors favor Donald Trump.
In most US states with such strong majorities one way or the other, we can be all but certain which candidate is going to win the Electoral College votes, which is why the contest comes down to just seven swing states: Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and North Carolina, where polls suggest the electorate is finally balanced. 4 years ago, Joe Biden won the state of Georgia by little more than 11,000 votes, a tiny margin. It was a result that prompted Donald Trump's infamous post-election phone call to officials in this state, asking them to find those few thousand votes that would swing Georgia his way, handing him the 16 Electoral College seats up for grabs and therefore the White House. They refused. The closer the actual vote in these swing states, the longer we'll have to wait for a definitive outcome, especially when you factor in the tens of millions of postal and early ballots that have to be counted separately. Last time round, it took 4 days for a winner to be declared.
John Sudworth. The FBI says several hoax bomb threats were directed at US polling stations in three battleground states, and that many of them appeared to come from Russian email domains. And that's not the only way foreign actors are said to have been involved in the campaign. US intelligence agencies say social media have been inundated with election-related content. This is one video that went viral in recent days. It falsely shows an individual who claims he's from Haiti saying he voted in Georgia. The US intelligence agencies are saying it's the work of Russian influence actors.
We came to America 6 months ago and we already have our American citizenship. We're voting Kamala Harris. Yesterday we voted in Gwinnett County and today we're voting in Fulton County.
BBC Verify has been studying this issue for months, and reporter Cheyenne Sardarizadeh told Rebecca Kesby about the sorts of videos they've been investigating.
From the moment we started tracking this campaign earlier in the year, most of the videos were sort of in line with Russia's interest in Ukraine. So they were anti-Ukraine, pro-Kremlin. But in the last couple of months, we've noticed that there's been attack towards targeting the US election campaign. And specifically, they're trying to make these videos to pretend like the BBC or Fox News or Sky News or ABC or CBS are saying that America is a country near collapse, that sort of the election is so dysfunctional, that there's widespread voter fraud. All of those things that are sort of supposed to sow discord in the US, that's the era that they're targeting.
Right. And so they're very convincing then in terms of the way that they're presented. And just expand a bit more on the messaging. What sort of people do they seem to be trying to target?
Well, because the videos are in English, obviously the target seems to be, and because many of them specifically are about the US and the election campaign, they seem to be targeted at people in the United States in particular. And they're sort of banking on the idea that people see these videos and believe them, and basically they cause sort of unrest or mistrust of authorities. Kamala Harris specifically also is targeted, and her husband, Douglas Emhoff, are sort of targeted in some of these videos.
And so you said that the US intelligence services believe they have evidence that it is coming from Russia. What is the solid evidence that that's the source?
US intelligence agencies together issued a joint statement, and they said that they have evidence from sort of previous activities, and also obviously there's stuff that they're not going to share with us, but they say that they have some level of confidence based on past monitoring and sort of pattern of behavior that this operation arises from Russia. Now, we also made the same conclusion when we were looking at this operation check, working with our colleagues at fact-checking organization Logically and Finnish investigative organization Check First. They also believe they have spotted IPs and that are based in Russia.
And Cheyenne, is it possible to know whether people believe these videos and whether they will make a difference, perhaps in this election?
Well, that is actually really difficult to say. What I can tell you is these videos, when you look at them, some of them in particular that have a sort of very well-made narrative, they're actually, it's not really that easy to spot that these are fake and these are not like real videos made by these news outlets, unless you go and check their websites, their social media accounts and see, you know, they've never posted this stuff. So it is possible, but thankfully, I think from what we've seen so far, the videos have actually failed to get that much engagement. You know, a handful of them have gone viral, and most of them actually haven't got that much attention. The videos that we're a bit more worried about, which is like not part of this operation, you know, in the last week or so, we have seen three specific videos targeting three of the key battleground states in the US, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Arizona. One in Pennsylvania was supposed to show one poll worker basically tearing apart mail-in ballots for Donald Trump. One in Georgia was supposed to show two Haitians illegally voting in Georgia. And another one in Arizona was supposed to show the Arizona Secretary of State being involved in a massive voter fraud operation. And all of these three videos, the US intelligence agencies also believe are the work of Russian influence actors. But the difference here is that these three videos have actually gone viral. Like a lot of people have unfortunately seen them, have been sharing them. And that's why very quickly US intelligence has come down and said these videos are fake.
BBC Verify's Cheyenne Sardarizadeh, and he was speaking to Rebecca Kesby. Now, obviously, there is going to be a lot going on before the next scheduled edition of the Global News Pod, so I will be back with a bonus edition, which we will probably record around 4:45 GMT. Ish, more or less, depending on what we have to say. And depending on when you are listening to this one, you can find live radio coverage of the US election on the BBC World Service. Still to come.
If you think when that was given in 1947, rationing was still going on, mostly people who would have received a piece of cake like that would have thought, I've got to eat it.
A princely sum at auction for a slice of cake from Queen Elizabeth's wedding. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has sacked his Defence Minister Yoav Gallant. Mr. Netanyahu said there had been too many gaps between them in the management of Israel's wars. Paul Henley spoke to John Donison in Jerusalem.
We've heard over the past year there have been reports of shouting matches between the two men over Israel's war strategy in Gaza in particular. Mr. Gallant was very much behind the war when it started just over a year ago. But in recent months, he has said the government should be prioritising a hostage release deal with Hamas ahead of continuing the war. And of course, that's something that Mr. Netanyahu has rejected.
Yoav Gallant was often described as a moderate to explain his difference of opinions with the Prime Minister, but he was a strong supporter of the war, wasn't he?
He was, and all these things are relative. He has been pretty hawkish over the past year about the war in Gaza, but his replacement, Israel Katz, is perhaps even more hawkish, and he clearly had strong differences of opinion with Mr. Netanyahu, not just over the war in Gaza, but also the issue of the exemption of Israel's ultra-Orthodox citizens from serving in the military. That is something that he thought shouldn't continue. He'd fallen out with Mr. Netanyahu over that, saying that, you know, the ultra-Orthodox at the time of war in Gaza and also now in Lebanon, they should be serving like everyone else.
Who is protesting in Tel Aviv and why?
Well, the opposition parties in Israel have called for protests this evening, but a lot of those protests are being driven by the Hostage Families Forum, who are very concerned, they say, over the sacking of Mr. Gallant. They have asked that Israel Katz, the new defence minister, should prioritise that hostage deal, something they feel that Mr. Netanyahu has not been doing. So we've had protests also outside the Prime Minister's office here in Jerusalem, not huge, so it is going to be interesting to see how those develop over coming days. I mean, you cannot ignore also the timing of this. Mr. Gallant had a much better relationship with the White House than the Prime Minister's relationship, which, to be honest, is pretty frosty at best. And the timing of this on the day of the US election, I think, can't be ignored.
That was John Donison in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Israel's war in Lebanon against the Iranian-backed Hezbollah group is expanding. The Bekaa Valley, the militant group's heartland in the east of the country, is coming under increasing attack. In the last week, more than 160 people have been killed in Israeli strikes there. Israel says it only targets Hezbollah sites, but rescue workers with Lebanon's Civil Defence Force say a large number of civilians are being killed. Our correspondent Quentin Somerville sent this report from Lebanon, and some listeners may find parts of his report upsetting.
I'm calculating the situation in my head, focusing if there are victims, if there is a fire, if we there was another airstrike.
Samir Ishkiye is 32 years old. For the last 14 years, he's been part of Lebanon's Civil Defence Force. He's the CDF's head of operations in Zahle, in the Bekaa Valley, in the east of the country. There's been an Israeli strike on an apartment block in El Karak, just minutes from his station. He's at the wheel of the ambulance on his way to the scene.
So two buildings have been affected, but one has taken a direct hit, and it's partly collapsed at the bottom here. This is a daily occurrence in this area, and the civil defence staff are telling us that when they arrive at a scene, there's half a dozen casualties that they're seeing every time. Even in 2006, the last war with Israel, there was nothing like the intensity of these bombardments.
Meanwhile, Samir is deep in the rubble. There are survivors underneath the pancake floors of the apartment block.
First victim I found was a child. I don't know if it's a girl or a boy, because it was a half child. Sorry to explain that, but it's from the stomach and up. From stomach and down, there is nothing. It's hard. It's too hard.
Samir says the strike left six dead, including three children. Israeli drones buzz overhead constantly. At night, Hezbollah rockets could be heard on more than half a dozen occasions being launched from nearby. I spent more than 2 weeks with the CDF and the Bekaa. The pattern of Israeli strikes and civilian casualties would be repeated again and again. Last Monday was one of the most intense bombardments on Baalbek, a city with a UNESCO-protected site of sprawling and magnificent Roman temples.
We're right by some of the Roman fortifications, and an entire house was wiped out here. Say five people were killed. The locals say that there's been a shift in the Israeli targeting, that they are increasingly targeting not military infrastructure, Hezbollah infrastructure, but civilian homes and apartments.
Israel said it had struck 110 Hezbollah-linked targets that day. Some two-thirds of the 63 killed were women and children, according to local officials. And the wards of the local hospital are crowded with the injured.
The cries you can hear in the background at Dar Amal Hospital, I'm in the children's intensive care unit, are from three-year-old Celine. She has burns to her face. An Israeli airstrike hit her home, killing both her parents. Two of her sisters were also killed. Her brother was killed. In the next room is two-year-old Kian. He was wounded in an Israeli airstrike. All he wants is his mum, Najat. She's by his bedside.
I'm crying because I'm afraid for my baby. If they think they can break us, they're mistaken. Even if I have to sacrifice my son, my husband, my father, my mother, my sister, and myself.
In the last month, Israel has unquestionably diminished Hezbollah's military might. But the group's strength has deeper roots, and here in the Bekaa Valley, its bombing campaign and the high civilian toll is for now hardening, not weakening, support for the group.
That was Quentin Somerville in Lebanon. A French court has convicted a gang of people smugglers after the biggest trial so far involving those operating small boats in the English Channel. All 18 members of the gang were given prison sentences. Their trial was the result of a Europe-wide operation targeting a smuggling network thought to be behind more than 10,000 small boat crossings to the UK. Our correspondent, Andrew Harding, reports.
This is a significant breakthrough for French prosecutors who'd asked for heavy prison sentences for the gang in the hope of deterring others. Most of those convicted today are young Kurdish men from Iraq, but one is an Iranian man arrested in the UK back in 2022 as part of a huge Europe-wide police operation. For several years, the gang controlled most of the small boat crossings from northern France. Their leader, already convicted on other smuggling charges, had been running the whole operation from a French prison cell. He now faces another 15 years in jail. The trial was complicated, involving multiple European nations and police forces. It generated 67 tons of paperwork. Some will claim the guilty verdicts as proof that these vast people smuggling networks can be unravelled. Others warn that the real ringleaders are safe outside Europe and that there are still plenty of willing recruits for what remains a very lucrative industry.
That was Andrew Harding. A 77-year-old piece of cake has sold at auction for more than $2,500. It's part of the wedding cake of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, and it was discovered in a suitcase belonging to a housekeeper who worked at the Palace of Holyrood House in Edinburgh. Joe Black reports.
From the palace balcony, Elizabeth and her husband waved to the cheering crowd.
November the 20th, 1947. The nation and the world witnessed the wedding of the young Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip. During the celebrations, the royal couple had several wedding cakes. Now, 77 years on, a slice of wedding cake from that day has gone under the hammer. It was found by Marion Polson's family. She had been a housekeeper at Holyrood House and was given the cake as a token of thanks for buying the newlyweds a dessert service. She died in the 1980s and it was found stashed away, still in its original presentation box, along with a letter from the future Queen, under a bed with some of her belongings. Today, the cake went to auction, its £500 estimate quickly surpassed.
This rare piece of wedding cake here, on the telephone in China, at £2,200 and selling £2,002.
Jonathan Benson is the director of Riemann Dancy, an auction house in Colchester.
It's a little slither of history. If you think when that was given in 1947, rationing was still going on, mostly, people who would have received a piece of cake like that would have thought, I've got to eat it, particularly if the Queen has just sent it to me.
It may be nearly 80 years old, but the appetite to own this particular piece of cake has now cost the buyer more than £2,000.
That was Joe Black. Now, move aside, Mu Deng, there is another pygmy hippo set for global stardom. If you've got no idea what I'm talking about, you clearly haven't spent enough time watching online videos of a tiny newborn hippopotamus, Mu Deng, wobbling around her pen in a Thai zoo earlier this year, and the internet went wild. And now Edinburgh Zoo has its own pygmy called Haggis. Johnny Appleyard is from the Hoofstock team at Edinburgh Zoo, and Ben Wright asked him, what makes Haggis so special?
For the species, it's a good ambassador animal. Pygmy hippos are endangered in the wild. There's only around 2,000 left. So for us as a charity as well, just be able to play a role in that in the much wider picture is quite an exciting time for us. And obviously for us as keepers, it's nice to have a little one around. It just makes our jobs a bit more exciting.
She's only 5 days old, I think. So I imagine not doing much apart from sleeping. But what's she like?
Yeah, she's good. She's actually already got a little bit of an attitude, just like her mum. She was born on Wednesday evening afternoon, so we did some close monitoring with her for the first couple of days, and then now she's just started to get a bit more mobile. So the first couple of days, she's just sleeping most of the time and hiding in the hay, but now she's starting to follow mum about, so she's getting up and about. And yeah, she's already got a little bit of an aggravated attitude, I would say. She's like just like her mum. Her mum's a bit feisty, and so is the little one.
Well, yeah, so what do you mean a bit of an attitude?
She just knows what she wants. She was telling her mum off yesterday, try because she wants to get some food, and she's running around and she's flicking her head about trying to get mum to lie down. So just knows what she wants.
And how are Haggis' parents getting on? Otto and Gloria.
So Otto at the moment, he's actually separate. So when the mum gives birth, She normally separates us off in the wild. So in captivity, we do the same thing, and she doesn't really tolerate the male being around. So he's outside now. He's in a separate area of the enclosure, milling himself and with no responsibilities whatsoever. And yeah, mum's spent most of all time with the baby. We separate her off and let her have a swim in the morning. But yeah, but just right now she's spending probably 90% of her day just laying down, recovering, and getting her energy back to feed the little one.
And how big is Haggis? Give us a sense. But bag of flour size?
Bigger? So she's currently, when we weighed her this morning, she's 6.5 kilos. So it's just probably just the size of a big bag of pasta.
Right. And eating?
Eating really well. Yeah, she started putting on weight about 200 grams a day when we first started weighing her, and now she's putting on a good hefty 0.5 kilo a day just through drinking mum's milk.
And full size, how big is a pygmy hippo?
A pygmy hippo is probably the same size as a really big Alsatian dog. So in terms of height-wise, and they weigh at least around 300 to 500 kilos.
So it wouldn't feel like a pygmy if it was running towards you?
No, it wouldn't. You definitely want to get out of the way.
That zoo in Thailand did a great PR job, didn't it, of posting videos of Moo Deng. Yeah. Will you be trying to harness Haggis for publicity, send her viral?
Judging at the moment, it seems to be doing the same thing. Obviously, that wasn't necessarily our intent, but obviously it's nice to jump on that. But the actual social media side of it is good because it's actually promoting the species. So that's our role as a charity, is to try and do our bit to promote the plight of these animals. So the fact that Moo Deng went viral and now this one seems to be doing the same thing, it's actually good for the species in the whole, because it just gets the species out there, especially pygmy hippos, who sometimes often come foul to being overshadowed by the bigger hippo.
That was Johnny Appleyard. And if you want to see a picture of Haggis, the pygmy hippo, I will obviously share it on altogether too many social media platforms, or you can just go to bbc.com. And that's it from us for now, but we will be back with a bonus edition of the Global News podcast in a few hours' time. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Rachel Wright. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.